Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
React in a positive way. We need positivity for this second half. Positivity, belief, positivity, belief. 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 Positivity, belief, positivity, belief.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by Alex Doyle, consultant at Optimize Potential and doctoral candidate in sport and exercise psychology at the University of Portsmouth. Welcome back, Alex.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Our resident sports psychologist. Alex, we spoke in some detail before about resilience and the concept of winners and bottlers and efficacy in individual and team performance and the reinvestment theory. And some of the stuff around, I guess, just general sports psychology approaches to managing a team. And you've since also written a piece for our newsletter, which was superb. Really, really enjoyed that. And you got in touch actually a while back because you listened to a conversation we had around something Jesus Perez said. And it started an email chain between us. And I thought, do you know what? We need to just get you back on here and have another conversation because there's so much still to talk about. How have you been, firstly?
Very good. Yeah. With the classic caveat, you know, I think everyone's using at the moment, like good, all things considered. But yes. Yeah. And looking forward to, yeah, the easing of all the lockdown rules and getting back to something looking a bit more like normality.
Yeah. I mean, just in time for spring, summer as well, which is great. So let me read to you this Jesus Perez quote, which was sent in by one of our listeners, Keith Weichel. It's quite a long one, so just bear with me. So Perez said, there are two ways in football to coach. You can coach with fear or you can coach the will to try. It's risk with knowledge. So if you say to a right back, be careful with this pass, don't do this pass, don't do that, then this guy will try to choose the other three options you didn't say, and it's dangerous. But if you say to this guy, be in a good position, be in a good angle, and then you try, because it's you on the pitch, I give you a position and then it's up to you. Now we have one guy playing who has good skill and takes a risk in possession. We don't tell him to be careful, but to try to read the situations. Sometimes you need to pass and go back and offer support. And so you picked up on the fact that this is a really kind of a frequent discussion in sports psychology around challenge versus threat thinking. Can you explain to us what you meant by that?
Yeah. So, yeah, as you said, the sort of the idea of kind of challenge and threat thinking is one that comes up a lot in sports psychology and across kind of almost any type of sport. And it sort of basically comes to the idea of, you know, the way that we perceive a situation, you know, any given situation that could be potentially a bit scary, we actually still have some control over that. So even if there's a circumstance that you can't control, the way you interpret it, the way you perceive it is still kind of vaguely within your control. And it also comes to the idea that there's basically sort of different stages of that kind of threat analysis. So in the moment, you see something happen and your brain goes through a couple of different phases. So you don't have an immediate reaction necessarily. So if you can see that situation as more of a challenge rather than directly as a threat, there's different reactions that your body will go through and different sort of psychological outcomes as well. And, you know, so that could be, you know, if you sort of are presented with a situation, so like one of the ones I sometimes use is like, if you imagine you're kind of there's like a sort of scene in a film, you're kind of in the canoe and like all of a sudden there's a rumble that kind of clearly there's a waterfall approaching, right? Like, you can either see that as a threat or a challenge. And the, one of the key things that might differentiate how you view that is, are you a good swimmer or not? Right. So swimming was my sport growing up. So for me, sitting in that boat, I might feel pretty comfortable. I can just jump out of the boat and swim to shore. The canoe might go over the edge, but that's fine. I'll be fine. So I'll be like, okay, well, this isn't ideal. And I think that's an important thing to bear in mind with the threat or challenge thinking is it's not necessarily an ideal outcome that you're looking for, but it's the ability to cope and having the resources to cope with that situation. So I might go, okay, cool. I'm abandoning the canoe. I'm going to swim to the side. Fine. If you're a poor swimmer, you don't have the resources in that moment. And so you will obviously see that as a much scarier moment or kind of circumstance. But you know, in that case, that example is very sort of maybe a bit kind of black or white, right? Depending on, are you a good swimmer or not a good swimmer? But what's interesting is how much of that is also sort of internal, right? So how much of your kind of existing sort of psychological profile, if you will, can help determine whether you go into a situation and you go, okay, cool, this could be a bit scary, but I'm going to see it as a challenge, or this could be a bit scary. Oh no, in fact, it's very scary. I am now threatened. And you know, that can often come down to things like, you know, a sort of, if you like being an underdog in a given situation, right? Like, so, you know, you kind of come up against, you know, like FA Cup draw, you're a sort of one of the minnows coming up against a big team, right? It's very easy. You could either be like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. We're going to get absolutely smashed. You know, maybe you're San Marino against England, right? Like, you can either go out there and be like, this is going to be humiliating, embarrassing, a waste of everyone's time. I'm going to get outclassed. Or you can go, there's nothing but upside for me here, right? I can go out. Worst case, I might get Harry Kane's shirt at the end of the match. Best case, I'll have played against some amazing professionals. I'll learn from that experience. And very best case, you pull off an amazing surprise shock result and you beat them. And then you go down in history as the team that beat England, right? So, and how you approach that is incredibly important, right? And it's the difference between essentially sort of your brain triggering a kind of your threat response, which can be very overwhelming and can lead to a sort of underperformance in those situations, or it can be like, okay, no, I'm excited. And you know, you'll still get kind of a nice hit of adrenaline, which is useful for your body because adrenaline primes your body to react physically, so that's helpful. But you don't want too much of it, and you don't, you know, because that can be where the problem starts. So having that difference in sort of perspective is really helpful. And there are ways of sort of trying to coach people to think about that, whether that's sort of, you know, and we spoke a little bit about some of this stuff before of, you know, if you can draw on sort of analogous situations, right? So if you can draw on something, and they don't have to be identical, but if you can kind of go back and find examples of when you have succeeded in the face of adversity or whatever, you can use those to sort of say like, okay, right, I've not necessarily faced this exact situation, but I do have confidence in my own resources to be adaptable or to be resilient or whatever. And so that can just sort of build that sense of, yeah, okay, I'll have a go, basically. Like, might get absolutely thrashed, this might be embarrassing, but I'll make the most of it, I'll learn what I can, and I'll take the positives.
It makes complete sense. So in framing the situation in the way that Jesus Perez did, what was he offering to his players in doing so?
I think, first of all, framing is exactly the right word, because I think what that quote does a really nice job of is sort of stating that there's two ways of thinking about things and two ways of communicating as well. And yeah, you know, this is a point I think we touched on the last time I was on the pod, but and also in the sort of question that I answered over email as well, was, you know, the way that you can think, you know, frame things and communicate things is really important as well, right? So, you know, the classic example is if you kind of focus on a negative outcome, your brain will still think about that negative outcome, right? So the classic, don't think of a pink elephant, immediately a pink elephant pops up in your head. Similarly, if you're taking a penalty kick, the least helpful thing to think is don't send this wide, right? Because the last words of those are send it wide. And that's sort of like lingering in your head as a thought. Whereas if you can go up and think top left corner or straight down the middle, have a clear idea and frame it positively, you're much more likely, you know, then there's none of that sort of doubt or that sort of focus on the negative outcome. You're just sort of framing it as a positive, and that's what you're going to try and do. And I think that's very much what that quote gets at as well, is, you know, right, here's the, I want you to do this. Rather than, and I think it's also quite nice because it sort of says, like, if you just say, you know, if a player has five decisions in a single moment that they could do, right, I could run, I could pass, I could try and beat the man, I could whatever, you can kind of, if you just say, don't do X, don't do one of those, it leaves all the other options open. And so that just leads to greater uncertainty. And in the moment, they might just be thinking, okay, right, I know what not to do, but I actually haven't been given very clear guidance about what I should do. So it's also helpful in that regard. Just, I think probably, and that's probably just good coaching as much as it is good psychology. It's just like, here's what I want you to do. Here is a clear plan A. Please do that, rather than, you know, this is plan F. So don't do plan F, because then it's unclear what else you do want. But I think all of that is then also is kind of, there's a nice acceptance in there about risk and the importance that risk can play, right? You know, football, as with so much in life, is a sort of risk reward balance, right? You take certain risks, they will pay off sometimes, they won't pay off others. And so it's about balancing that decision as well, right? So it's, and what I like there is a sort of an acceptance that, you know, sometimes it is good to take risks, and we have players in the squad at the moment who take risks that pay off, and sometimes they don't, and that's great, right? Like, that's how you unlock defenses sometimes, right? You can't just always play the safest pass, but that won't always work. And I think there's a nice sort of touch of kind of essentially compassion in that, you know, if you are doing the right thing and you are making the sort of the right decision, you're trying to take a calculated risk that would be worthwhile, but sometimes it still just won't quite go to plan, right? And that's fair enough, right? Like, that is, again, you know, sort of coming back to topic that we spoke about last time, if you're thinking about in terms of control, like, you can't always control exactly what's going to happen, right? Even in the just milliseconds from when you look to play a slightly risky pass or something, right? Players move positions, your player maybe has stopped the run you thought they were going to make, or a defender has seen it and has reacted quicker than you expected, or whatever. So it could, in the moment that you made the decision, have been the right decision. And by the time the ball gets to where it's going, even if you've executed it perfectly, it might just not quite have worked it out right. So there's so many variables in there that it would be incredibly harsh to sort of castigate that player and say, like, you shouldn't have taken that risk, because actually sometimes that's exactly what they should have been doing. And so I think all of that just really helpfully sort of ties into this idea of, like, just kind of building up an attitude whereby you will occasionally see opportunities, and rather than seeing them as a threat of, oh, if I try this risky chip or, you know, back heel or whatever, like, it will go wrong. It will, and then I will get dropped, or I will be in trouble with the gaffer or whatever. If you are constantly thinking like that, that's kind of very much the epitome of that sort of threat state thinking. Whereas if you can kind of go, yeah, no, I'm going to risk it, I'm going to try that risky pass, then that's sort of more of that, like, yeah, because there's upside to this. There's, even though it's maybe a little bit unlikely, it's still that challenge sort of sense of, like, there are probably benefits here that I can get from this.
It sounds very sort of optimistic and what's the word? It feels like the glass is half full and progressive and a growth mindset and all these things. But are there any situations in which the threat state would be the better thing to aim for like a team of psychologists working with a team? Is there any sort of scenario where you think it would be useful to do the opposite of what you've just described?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, our threat state, you know, our bodies, our brains are still very much rooted in our sort of cave person ancestry, right? Like, we still basically walk around with the same brains that we did a couple of hundred thousand years ago, when having a threat reaction was extremely helpful, right? Like, if you, and the way that, you know, that sort of fight or flight response, or now it's sort of more often called fight, flight or freeze, but like, is, you know, if you walk into, you're walking through the woods and you find one of your clan mates and they've had their leg bitten off by something, right? It is good for your body to go, oh, threat, like, and react accordingly, right? So that's where that comes from. And it, I think it's also very important to acknowledge that, that part of our brain is still definitely trying to help. It's just that it's incredibly ill-suited to life in 2021. Like, we just don't really encounter saber-toothed tigers on the tube. So we don't really need that response nearly as often as our brain thinks it does. And that because our brain isn't really adapted, it can get triggered by all sorts of aspects of modern life where our brain goes, ah, a threat, even though it's just a picture on Instagram or it's just your boss trying to give you some constructive feedback or whatever it happens to be, that can still trigger those threat instincts. All of which was me sort of stalling for time while I tried to think of any sporting situations where it might be helpful. Off the top of my head, I can't really. I think even if you, you know, even thinking about, say, the Ajax Champions League match, right, where it was really do or die in that last, you know, last half of the match away, like, is you still want that challenge sense of there's still some upside, right? Like, let's, you know, go out there, play the best that we want, you know, that we can, play the way we want to play, take some chances, take some risks, and see what happens. Whereas I think if, you know, if you were in a, and that's obviously an incredibly extreme scenario, right? Is and there is huge upside, right? Like, nothing sort of epitomizes that more, right? Like, there is a reason that anyone who was a Spurs fan for that match will live in your brain, like, till the day you die, right? Is because there was enormous upside from having the challenge mindset in that moment, because they pulled it off, right? And so, yeah, I can't really think of any scenarios necessarily in a sporting situation where the threat state would really be helpful. My brain is ticking. I'm wondering whether conceivably in like a combat sport, maybe, okay, like, you know, where you are actually sort of potentially in kind of more physical peril, conceivably maybe. But I think even there, you'd still want to kind of have that challenge mentality to, you know, stick to your game plan, do what you can, learn from it, get the most out of it, because otherwise I think you've basically mentally sort of thrown in the towel at that point.
That makes complete sense. Yeah, no, I was just interested in sort of, because all of these things are options, right? These are, I say options as if you're controlling robots, and of course sportsmen are human beings and it's not that simple, but these are techniques that can be used to promote different perspectives and different focuses and different ways of approaching matches and scenarios and scenarios within matches. So I guess it's interesting to try and understand when you might use one technique and when you might use another. I guess it's also worth considering the influence that a long-term approach in this way might have on a team and the opposite. So when might, what are the side effects of constantly? So for example, if you've taken the approach of developing a challenge mindset for your team across the course of a season, and yet everything's going wrong for them on the pitch, what's the player meant to think at the end of that?
I mean, I think, you know, and you know, coming back to the sort of canoe example, right, which I'll admit is it's not perfect, but you know, at least they're like, you know, the why it is quite helpful is like, it's not ideal, right? Like, in an ideal world, you'd have just carried on comfortably sailing down a nice friendly stream in your canoe full of your supplies or whatever. Like, so the fact that your canoe has gone over the waterfall is not ideal, but you've come out okay, right? It's not the best scenario. And so I think even, you know, even if you come out of a season where you have sort of, you've tried your hardest, you've tried to maintain that challenge mindset, if you've actually really been sort of living that challenge mindset, you will at least still take the positives, right? So
sure,
even if you're a club who's been, you know, you've been promoted to Premier League, you've been absolutely smashed, you get relegated, like, you might look at that and go, that was kind of a horrible waste of time, or you can go, well, there was still a season where I was a Premier League footballer, I got to play against some of the best players in the world, I got to learn from that, I got to develop my game. You know, there are plenty of positives you can take And I think that that would all be part and parcel of that sort of challenge mindset. Probably be happening on a micro scale as well. I think that'll be happening match to match as well.
Yeah. And I remember when we spoke before, you spoke a lot about setting goals and having realistic goals. And I guess the idea would be that if your goals were realistic in the first place, then you can still judge them in some way and find positives from even, you know, Huddersfield, for example, the terrible season that they had in the Premier League. I'm sure that they would still find some positives because they'd have had a level of realism in their goals at the start of the season.
And I think the goal setting thing ties quite nicely into that, because also if you're looking at just an outcome, we spoke about the difference between sort of outcome goals as a kind of big overarching dream, right? And maybe that's something like, okay, right, we've just been promoted, so our outcome goal is we just want to stay in the Premier League, right? So survival. Like, but you still need to break that down into the performance goal. So what are you going to do as a team week in, week out to make that happen? Like, how? And then you break that down into the process goals, so that each player and also as a team, you know what it is you're going to be doing in training in order to give you those performances that you think will achieve that goal. So, so I think then within that, even if you've been absolutely thumped, you know, and you're rooted to the bottom of the table, you might still be able to draw benefits from the fact that, like, well, actually, no, like, we went out there with a game plan, we were able to play it, we were improving. And, you know, then you can kind of try and build from there. And you know, hopefully, you know, in that circumstance, like, you would hope that that will start to have an impact on your performances and then the outcome. But also that sometimes, like, you know, that there is just a golf in class, right? So yeah. Realistically, like, that's not always going to be possible. There's not always going to be a fairy tale sort of escape at the end of the season. But, you know, you still try and take from it what you can.
God, I mean, it must be so difficult when you're managing a team who is clearly worse than all the other teams, to try and instill that mentality amongst your players that they actually have a chance in any game. I mean, I take your point earlier about the sort of giant killing, the you're sort of going into a match thinking, well, I've got nothing to lose here, so it doesn't matter. But trying to do that every week must be, gosh, really difficult.
Yeah, and it may also, you know, I guess if you're that manager, like, probably trying to sort of focus on things like, you know, like, especially if you're a team who's, like, never or rarely been in the Premier League, like, so, like, what does that mean to the fans, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, those long-standing fans who haven't seen your team in the Premier League for a decade or ever, or whatever, you know, like, is, you know, all right, well, at least, like, let's go out there, let's put on a good show for them, right? Like, even if it's become clear that you're already relegated or pretty much guaranteed to be relegated halfway through the season, you might still try and just sort of, like, play for pride, play for some self-respect, play for the fans, those kind of things. So I think if I were in that scenario, I would be trying to sort of frame things in that sort of way, but still sort of coming back to you, and therefore, you know, this is how we want to play. Here are the skills that we need to work on, the positioning, the blah, 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 all of those things.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that's kind of what Wickham are experiencing in the Championship this year, playing at a level that they're just not used to playing at. And yet they're able to take something from it because, I mean, if nothing else, players are getting exposure to a level of football they've never played at before. So they're sort of creating a legacy for themselves and potentially earning transfers in the long run. I think, Alex, this is also pertinent. This discussion around challenge or threat thinking is pertinent to another discussion we had on a different podcast recently around the times at which teams play their matches. We had a question particularly around, is it beneficial to play last thing on a Sunday, or like, would you rather play first thing on the Saturday or Friday night, as they are nowadays? And I forget who it was. I apologise to a listener who sent the question in. They were talking about participating in spelling bees and whether they prefer to go first or second. And yeah, we had an interesting discussion about it. We all sort of placed ourselves in that situation. I would rather go first, I think, on reflection. But presumably this can be managed by the team manager, the team of sports psychologists as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is. That's another sort of prime example of how your perception of a situation can impact it, right? Like, there is no structural or like mathematical benefit in playing on the Friday night or the Sunday evening, like, it's still 3 points for a win, right? So in those terms, going out there and winning the match is still as important, right? You still play 38 games over the course of a season, all the rest of it, you know, so like it doesn't actually give you an advantage in any sort of concrete mathematical way. Of course there are psychological factors, but you could just as easily spin it either way round, right? Like, and so I think you can, you know, I think the when you guys answered that question on the podcast, you started sort of talking about the season where we were chasing Leicester, right? And we were constantly playing on the Sunday because we were in Europe. So it was, we were always sort of chasing. We already knew the result. And there's kind of two ways of looking at that as well, right? And it almost comes back to that sort of underdog mentality, if that's how you want to view that challenge threat, is you kind of go, okay, well, the pressure is starting to build on Leicester, right? Like they've won their Saturday lunchtime kickoff or whatever. We just, like, we can just do whatever, right? That means that we've gone 3 points behind them. So if we can pick up those 3 points, excellent, we keep the pressure on them. But like, we, you know, there's basically sort of no downside because we're already behind them, so we can start catching them up again. We can't overtake them, so that's kind of off the table, right? We can't get 6 points for this win, so that's just off the table. But, and again, I think it then sort of comes back to that focusing on the processes and focusing on the performance, right? Is you would, I think, as much as possible, basically just sort of say, like, we're going to go out there and we're going to play, you know, it sounds like a cliche, but we're going to play our game, right? Like that's what you want, whether that's kind of because you have a clear overarching sort of strategic philosophy of like, this is the way we always play, or if it's more of a sort of chop and change depending on your opponent, that could also feasibly be your kind of philosophy as well. But whatever it is, you have a clear plan and you make it about that Spurs squad, right? You kind of try to put the chasing bit out of your mind as much as possible, but to the extent that you do think about it, you just try and frame it as, yeah, we've got a challenge here, like Leicester are running away with it and every other team in the country seems to be helping them. The press absolutely love that they're that they're top of the league. Basically, you can kind of turn around and go, well, screw it, like, we're still going to catch them, we're going to do our thing, we're going to work hard, and when we do overhaul them, it will not just be the greatest season for Tottenham since the 60s, it will also be an amazing comeback where we caught them by however many points and we were playing in Europe. And, you know, like, and you can start to spin all of those sort of negative, potentially negative attributes, you start to spin them as, well, won't this be cool when we pull it off? And if you can sort of start to tap into that kind of frame of mind, even just talking to you now, I'm getting excited by that concept, right? Of like, wouldn't that be cool? And it would have been immensely cool. But, you know, I think if you can start sort of framing things in those ways, you start to tap into that sort of energy and enthusiasm and confidence, right?
It makes so much sense. And I think this leads quite nicely onto the next thing that we're going to talk about, which is identity and the identity of a team. And I think Spurs in some ways uniquely do have an identity, and that identity has been oft criticized. Lads, it's Tottenham springs to mind. Mm-hmm. But it's an identity for a team that plays with flair, doesn't necessarily, certainly in modern times, win things, but plays with a particular style, with a particular swagger, and how that might be affected by having a manager who is in some ways the opposite. I mean, he does win things. He clearly has spent his career winning things over and over and over again, but with a reputation and perhaps an identity which has pragmatism at its heart. Talk to us about how, the impact that might have.
Yeah, so, I mean, identity is a really helpful sort of feature, or, you know, and it's been shown to be helpful for, last time I was on, we talked about self-efficacy, so, which is sort of broadly kind of self-confidence, right? The confidence that you can achieve a thing. And identity, having a kind of clear team identity, has been shown to be helpful for building that sort of collective efficacy in a group of individuals. And it's also helpful for, in terms of the sort of cohesion of the group, right? If you have sort of certain attributes that you can all rally around, that's helpful. You can build team cohesion around those features. And yeah, I think for Tottenham, that sort of that identity is really ingrained in the club's kind of DNA, right? Like whether it's the sort of the club motto, to dare is to do, or whether it's the sort of Bill Nick quotes or whatever. And I think it goes all the way to, you know, when you go to White Hart Lane and they play the video before the team comes out and they say, "We are Tottenham." And, you know, they actually, in preparation for this, I went and tried to find it online. And like the way that they emphasize who Tottenham are as a club is really crystal clear. You know, like it goes through, like, you know, we are the flick, the trick, the 30-yard free kick. We are the lob, the chip, the dummy, the volley, right? Like, I mean, there's no doubt here. They're not like, we are the low block counter. Like, so there is a real sense there of like, that's the club you're joining and that's who we are and how we play. And that's almost certainly helpful, I guess, from a coaching perspective, I would imagine. I'm not a coach, but I can imagine if you come into a club and that already aligns with how you want to coach, that's going to be helpful because you're going to have the fan base on side, the, you know, the club directors, you're going to have more of the players kind of already aligned to you. So that's helpful as well. But it's also, if that identity is already there and there is already a sort of good sense of it, as I think there must be at Tottenham, right? Like, I don't think you could play for Tottenham and avoid it. And then you come in with a much more sort of pragmatic approach. I think there is a chance that that starts to unravel any sort of identity or and sense of either confidence that comes from that or a sense of sort of cohesion that comes from that. And, you know, I think, you know, again, as a sort of the important caveats that I used a lot on the last time I was on, like, firstly, you know, I don't know Jose Mourinho. I don't know any of the Spurs squad. I don't work with them. I couldn't tell you if I had. but also that, you know, I've won precisely zero major footballing competitions. So, you know, there is a real sense there that, you know, so with all of that kind of said, like, nonetheless, I kind of feel like if you come in with a sort of philosophy that is quite, as you said, sort of like pretty much the opposite of any identity that sort of already exists, I think that is tricky. That's certainly a hurdle that would need to be overcome. And I think it's, you know, possible to see some of that kind of fallout as a result of that, I guess.
I mean, it makes complete sense. Essentially, he's really got his work cut out for him if he wants to do things in a different way. Partly because it's built into the branding. I mean, such is football now that literally, as you say, the club motto is written all over the stadium, all over the training ground. Players will just hear this lingo constantly. They'll be asked to say lines for bits that are put out on social media channels. And it will just be ingrained in them to hear things relating to our style, our footballing culture, philosophy. And equally, I imagine sort of stepping aside slightly from the club motto, but I imagine when Pochettino came in as this sort of manager who was obsessed with pressing, I imagine that really was almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy because everyone was talking around Tottenham being a pressing team.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow, or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. ALLBIRDS.com, code FRESHSOCKS.
That's really helpful, I assume, that, you know, constant talk of look at this team pressing like we've never seen players press before in the Premier League, I guess, is on message with what they want to happen, and so it's helpful.
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, I guess this is a little speculative, but I would imagine that coming in with a clear philosophy of how you want to play will help build an identity for your team, you know, so... Yeah. Like, you know, if you have someone come in, whether it's Poch or whoever, like if you come in and you've got a very clear sort of strategy, like this is how we're going to set up, this is how we're going to play, this is what we're going to do, that will help build. You could, you know, if you were trying to overcome an identity that's kind of long-standing and built into the sort of the club DNA, then I think you would need to be quite clear in what you were replacing it with. Mm-hmm. And I think there is something potentially therefore a little bit also potentially just a bit confusing in the way that we have heard sort of Jose talk about some of the stuff that's been happening at Spurs. Like, again, this is a bit speculative and we can only see what he's saying to the press and all the rest of it, and then the rest is conjecture. But, you know, when he came in, there was a lot of talk about how he was going to, you know, he changed his ways. He had spent the time, you know, since Man United reflecting and developing and, you know, all the rest of it. So there, I think there was an initial optimism amongst the Spurs community of like, oh, okay, well, maybe we will still get a bit of the flair, the to do is to dare, the all the rest of it. Then we sort of didn't get that. Like, and we've been, and I think over the course of Mourinho's tenure, it's that there have seemingly been sort of quite blocks of different strategies almost. There have been times where we really have been a sort of counter-attacking team. There's been times where we've looked like maybe we're actually trying to play a bit more possession, but maybe not. And like those have sort of come and gone. And so I can, if you were trying to forge a new identity, that feels a little bit unhelpful and unclear as well. The other thing, and again, I think this is probably a little speculative, but there's sort of concepts from that come from kind of social psychology around sort of how you develop kind of group cohesion, and identity is sort of part and parcel of that. But it's sort of the idea that like you have kind of in groups and out groups. So basically, you know, like you have a group of people with whom you have things in common and you therefore bond around that sort of commonality, right? And this is, you know, all of human society has this, right? So this could be you got two Spurs fans meet each other in a pub for the first time and they chat about how much they love Spurs. They bond over that commonality. All of a sudden, if you put them in front of an Arsenal fan, you've got in-group, out-group, right? The Spurs fans and the Arsenal fans. But then all of a sudden, if you put all of those guys and you cluster them together as football fans and you put them opposite a whole bunch of people who are insisting that cricket or rugby or tiddlywinks is the greatest sport on earth, all of a sudden the Spurs and the Arsenal fans might get along and be like, no, mate, what are you talking about? Cricket's rubbish or whatever, right? So the in-group, out-group thing is very contextual, right? It depends how you're defining it in the moment and who the out-group is, who the in-group is. And even conceivably then within the Spurs community, you can have in-groups and out-groups, right? So very literally, you might have Jose in, Jose out. That is a sort of in-group, out-group. So if you are a dedicated Jose in person, you will bond with other Jose fans on that basis and be skeptical or sort of less willing to engage with the people who fall into that out-group in that context. So that's where an identity can also be really helpful, because you can kind of say, here are some attributes of this football club that we will all buy into, and this will make us a stronger in-group, a more cohesive in-group. And I think there's something quite interesting, and this is very unscientific, but my recollection of sort of peak Mourinho years was he was incredibly good at creating an in-group that included him with all of his players. So my recollection of his sort of biggest, most controversial statements were always like Chelsea had lost, someone had had a bad game, and he would just come out immediately afterwards and the first interview would say, Jose, you lost, was that John Terry's fault, or something along those lines? And he'd go, no, it's the refs, they're all bribed, you know, the game was rigged against us, right? So the back page the next day is Jose's been fined for saying this about refs. And it's not until the second paragraph of the article that it says, as part of a 2-0 defeat at home to Arsenal or whatever, like, and he was shielding it, right? He was saying, like, this is us against them, right? Like, come on, lads, you're part of my group. I'm protecting you. But also, like, you know, when he would go on his sort of kind of slightly baffling conspiracy theories about how UEFA wanted Barcelona to win the Champions League when he was at Real Madrid. And again, that's a kind of us versus them. So it's very classic in-group, out-group. We are Real Madrid. We are an in-group. And the rest of the world is united against us to try and make sure that Barcelona win the Champions League. That really can foster some really strong team camaraderie and team unity under those circumstances. So that can be really helpful and powerful, especially if you've got a club that maybe doesn't have a strong identity already, right? If you don't have characteristics to cling to immediately when you walk through the door, you can create some. You can kind of create these sort of straw man bad guys, scapegoats, whatever, to rail against, and you build the commonality in your group around that. And I think what's interesting is, I think you could, certainly that's my impression of how he used to handle the press. And I wonder whether there's been a bit of a shift in that, so that now, you know, and arguably maybe there's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, now that he feels like he's maybe under a bit more personal pressure for the performances of the teams he manages, there's a bit more, no, this wasn't me, this was the players.
I see.
And so all of a sudden, he's essentially creating out-groups. Like, he's putting himself in an in-group and the players as an out-group. And of course, the players will sense that. So they will then start to go, oh, hang on, I thought we were all one big group, but now he's saying this is my fault or our fault. And that could potentially be unhelpful for that team sort of cohesion.
And then you get the club captains, Hugo Lloris, saying, well, look, there are some players who are playing unacceptably and behaving badly, which just adds to that. That's really interesting. And actually, in some ways, what you've just described, Alex, completely explains the Mourinhistas, as he calls them, the fan club that he essentially has, who follow him everywhere. They're all just part of the in-group. They're the people that he's taken on his journey from day one and builds up from club to club to club. It makes complete sense.
Yeah. And then you can factor in, and this is, you factor in sort of the idea of confirmation bias, which is a psychological phenomenon that absolutely everyone on earth is susceptible to, where you have a pre-existing belief and you overemphasize the evidence that supports it and you filter out the evidence that doesn't, right? So all of a sudden, if you believe that Jose Mourinho is God's gift to football and is the best football manager that's ever lived, you overemphasize his successes, his wins on a sort of grand scheme, grand level, or on a sort of week-to-week basis. And you're more likely to sort of assign blame or find evidence that sort of continues to, reinforce that belief. So absolutely. And so being able to kind of, that sort of cognitive bias, confirmation bias is a hugely powerful thing that everyone is susceptible to, and it plays a part in everyone's life on a day-to-day basis. It's definitely something people, ideally would be aware of and try to sort of mitigate, because it can be, it's happening instantly in your own head and you don't necessarily pay attention to it, but it can essentially mean that a lot of the things you might believe are reasonably unfounded or certainly aren't sort of backed by evidence to the extent that you might think that they are. I think that's a helpful thing to sort of acknowledge from time to time.
Definitely. And you're speaking to the right person now. I'm certainly guilty from time to time. I have loads of questions for you from our ex-subs mainly, but this one first is from Bardi, actually, who says, do you have any thoughts on penalty shootouts? And he points out that we've been pretty bad apart from the Audi Cup and Chelsea this year. But this is an area of expertise for you, really, isn't it? You're literally writing about this, aren't you?
Yeah. So my research interest is in choking under pressure. So sort of those kind of highly pressurized moments, whether you kind of you go to pieces or not. And so obviously, penalty shootouts would be potentially examples of that. And I mean, there's some very interesting stuff. I mean, at the most kind of fundamental level, anything you can do to sort of increase that sort of sense of efficacy is going to be helpful. So, things like practicing penalties, and therefore kind of, I know that we've had kind of England football managers at times who've sort of laughed off the idea of practicing penalties as though that would be the silliest thing in the world. That to me is sort of madness. Like, you should absolutely be practicing them. And obviously you should be practicing them across many different players in the squad if you know that there is a possibility of a penalty shootout, because you can't just have Harry Kane take all of the penalties. So you need to try and instill that sense of confidence into as many players as possible so that you have people to call on who will have a sort of baseline of confidence. There are also some sort of there are some interesting bits of research on how you can potentially sort of offset pressure and any sort of underperformance that might come from that. So there's some quite interesting research that actually squeezing a stress ball with your left hand can help reduce the underperformance, which is sort of so astonishingly simple that, you know, you could easily imagine that if that sort of continues to be replicated, like by the next, you know, by 2022, any penalty shootout, you'd have people squeezing stress balls before the penalty kicks. I'm personally a little, I think there's some kind of limitations in that research. It's always incredibly hard studying choking because it's sort of dependent on these incredibly pressurized situations. To do that experimentally is tricky. There is only so much you can do as an experimenter, both practically and also ethically, to create that sense of pressure while still measuring people's performance. So some researchers go back and they have sort of analyzed the outcomes of penalty shootouts over time. So obviously you can just go back and watch the footage and see whether or not people have missed or not. So that can be sort of useful. Of course, you can't get any sense of how subjectively they felt about the sense of pressure in that moment, right? Someone might be cool as ice, even in a World Cup final, taking the decisive penalty. They may walk up and just be like, no, I've got this, right? Because they've got enormous sense of confidence in that situation and therefore be reasonably unaware of that sense of pressure. So for them, it would be hard to say whether they choked or not, because if they then struck it, you know, the classic sign of the Roberto Baggio, right? Like he skying the penalty in the World Cup final years and years and years ago now. But like that's often cited as an example of choking. But is it? Like we don't know, unless you were to talk to him and say, like, how much pressure did you feel? And do you think that's the reason you missed it? Because he'd also, because I've looked into it a bit, like he was basically coming back from injury into that World Cup, right? So he might also just have been absolutely knackered because he had just played full match, extra time, coming back, he probably wasn't match fit. So maybe he was just exhausted and that was what contributed to missing that penalty. So, you know, it's sometimes hard to sort of figure out the exact nuances of what you can attribute to the pressure and what might be something else. But nonetheless, if you are, you know, there's kind of no harm in it, especially with the sort of the simple things like squeezing a stress ball. Why would you not? You could, you know, definitely have a crack at that and see if that helps. And yeah, I mean, that would be definitely helpful. But yeah, in general, it's going to be things like, you know, just building confidence, practice. You can do things like imagery. So, which I think we may have spoken about last time, but the sort of playing through scenarios essentially in your head. So practicing those different things. The positive framing, right? So going up with a clear idea of like what you do want to achieve rather than thinking about what you don't want to achieve. Those are always going to be helpful. There's another sort of reasonably sort of classic techniques for just trying to sort of manage your kind of anxiety or stress levels in those moments. So breathing exercises, relaxation exercises, those kind of things can help offset that sort of sense of anxiety. Some other ones that are harder potentially to do in the moment, but like things like listening to music have been shown to reduce senses of anxiety. I don't know if these guys can, you know, pull out their sponsored Beats by Dre headphones, but you know, like in the minute before a penalty shootout, if they could, that might help. But yeah, there are certain sort of little things you can do. But also, you know, even coming back to the idea of just sort of like looking at previous examples. So actually the fact that we reasonably recently did win a penalty shootout against Chelsea is potentially very helpful, right? Like that is something that certainly if I was the sports psychologist at Spurs or the manager at Spurs, I would definitely be emphasizing that the next time we were in a match where it might go to penalties and just before the penalty, guys, you've got this, you've done this before. I've seen you guys win a penalty shootout. Go get them, that kind of angle, I guess.
So there you go, Bardi. Basically, what Alex is saying is you need to order some extra inch branded stress balls, probably 11 of them, and send them to Hotspur Way. Another question, I really like this one as well. This was from Jess, another of our ex-subs. And I think this is a really good point. It's quite a long one. I'm going to read most of it because I think it's all relevant. So Jess says, I was wondering how much the lack of generic mental health and psychology literacy amongst men, which she says is a generalisation, impacts on the perceived legitimacy of sports psychology amongst high-level sports people. I remember listening to the EP with Alex and hearing terms that me and my friends, all of us queer women in our mid-20s from uni-educated backgrounds, are very comfortable with, things like self-efficacy, talking about our mental health conditions, etc., but wondered if our society's lack of methods to discuss these with younger men and boys has an impact on the ability for top male athletes to internalise these concepts early enough in their careers. And that resonated hugely with me. I mean, I'm 37. I don't recall thinking about, let alone talking about my mental health until I was at least 19, which I think speaks volumes. So have you found that difficult to break through, Alex?
Yeah, I think, you know, sort of the short answer is like, is that a factor? Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, and helpfully, I think there's been, you know, some big pushes just sort of generally to kind of increase men's mental health awareness and sort of talk about, you know, that there are some really terrifying statistics on sort of male suicide and things like that, which, you know, are not all of them necessarily, but are broadly preventable just by, you know, I think just by guys being a bit more willing to talk about how they're feeling. And, you know, it's something that, yeah, I get ridiculed for quite a lot, that, you know, if I go, you know, in previous times going, you know, I'd go and hang out with my mates and we'd sit in a pub or something and we would just talk about sport for 3 or 4 hours. And then I'd come home and my wife would sort of go like, so how were they? And I'd go, I don't know. I have no idea. But, you know, I now know what they all think about their respective football teams. And, you know, that's about it. So, yeah, I think there's definitely something there. And I think it sort of, it needs a bit more from men, you know, just to sort of try and work a bit harder at that. So sort of actively trying to ask, you know, there's a sort of a classic kind of ask twice, like, so how are you doing?
Yeah,
but how are you doing kind of thing? Because you'll get fine or could be worse or something as a response, but that's maybe not all that's going on. I think that probably, I would hope that is changing a bit in general, that, you know, men are becoming a bit more aware of that and aware of some of the repercussions of that, of kind of not talking about their feelings or the mental health and being sort of willing to open up. I think in a sort of purely sporting setting, it's definitely a factor. I think you do probably get a sort of greater reluctance potentially from men, and I think often, you know, there's a sort of probably a kind of, it varies a little bit by age as well, that you might have, you know, the kind of late teens, sort of adolescent kind of age where they sort of don't want to be perceived as weak by teammates or friends or whatever, so there might be a little bit more sort of reluctance to do so there. I think also though it's actually quite interesting that I think it probably varies a good amount by sport as well. I think this is a bit speculative, but maybe there's to some extent a bit of a sort of socioeconomic factor in that as well. But for example, like cricket has been really open about mental health topics and has been very accepting of sports psychology for far longer than football has. And you've had very high profile cricketers who've retired from the game, basically saying like, no, I've got to look after my mental health. And the cricket community has rallied around them and gone, absolutely do what's right for you. In a way that perhaps isn't necessarily true. You know, we've got a sort of an increasing number of footballers who have come out, you know, a couple from Spurs, you know, Aaron Lennon and, you know, Danny Rose have been sort of reasonably forthright in talking about their mental health issues. And I think that's all good. You know, you need those people to sort of blaze that trail and talk about those things openly. But I think there's a bit of a sense of maybe catch up there. There's also like the New Zealand All Blacks rugby team are very good at advertising lots of the work that they do with sports psychologists and on sort of mental health. I think that's also conceivably just that New Zealand loves rugby in a way that basically, you know, very few countries love a sport the way that New Zealanders love rugby. Like, you know, probably Brazil and football and India and cricket are kind of the only comparable ones. But, you know, so if you're an All Black, you are kind of a demigod already. So if you, you know, it's a great platform. There's a sort of sense of security that comes from that potentially, that you can kind of feel open to talk about some of these things. New Zealand's obviously also quite a sort of liberal leaning country as well. Maybe they just, as a disposition there's probably a greater sense of kind of maybe just being a bit more open on some of these topics anyway. And even I think probably just the fact that if you're a 6'8" rugby player who weighs 250 kilograms and you come out and go, here's what I feel, no one's going to turn around and be like, well, I reckon you're a bit of a wimp, because I'm not sure I'd want to be the one who says that to the to the guy who's 6'8". So yeah, but I think there's a million different factors that play into that, but for sure I think it is certainly an issue. I think it's one that's changing. It's one that I think hopefully will continue to change, and hopefully even change at a faster pace. But yeah, it's a tough one.
Do you see that as part of your job? So if you're given a brief to go in and work with a sports team or an individual to improve their sporting performance, do you see it as part of your role to talk about how they're feeling generally? Is that something you do by default?
So for sure. I mean, I think it can be quite tempting to think of sports people, particularly kind of elite sports people, as sort of emotionless robots. Sometimes that could be the perception of the sort of the fans and the media, but of course they're not, right? And so I think sometimes it's a case of, you know, I have to kind of, you know, as a sports psychologist, you have to sort of go into an organization and sort of try to basically also just sort of put the case for sports psychology, so sort of tell them what they can get out of it. And often it's, you know, a case that people don't necessarily understand what sports psychology is in the first place. So you're sort of trying to sort of say, like, here's how I can help, here's things I can do for you. But also that, you know, it's impossible to differentiate the sports person from the person. So you almost certainly, you know, if someone is having struggles in their personal life, whether that's a sort of a relationship or, you know, any sort of other worries, like it's almost certainly going to have some sort of impact on how their training, their focus levels, their motivation levels, their performance levels, all the rest of it. So it's basically impossible not to try to delve into some of that. Obviously some of that is then a bit sort of restricted potentially by how much time you have available with with that sports person. So if you are dealing with a big organization and you know that you have really limited time, you might try to focus on some of the more sort of slightly superficial, I don't love that word, but like those kind of just focus on the sporting performance, because you know you don't necessarily want to open a can of worms you then don't have the time and energy and access to help clear up. So there's an element there of okay, all right, well, if you come to me and you've got a very clear problem with your game that you want addressed, and I know I only see you for an hour once a month, I might just focus on, okay, well, have you tried some visualization or some goal setting or you know, something like that, without trying to get into some of the sort of deeper underlying things. But
would there then be a kind of ethical responsibility to refer them on for talking therapy or something?
Yeah, for sure. And so the sort of, certainly if as a sports psychologist you kind of come across someone who's got sort of pretty clear sort of serious mental illness, we have to refer them on to a clinical psychologist or someone who would have the capabilities to do that, because we aren't trained to sort of deal with someone who's got an eating disorder or sort of severe depression or whatever. So for those kind of things we would have to refer on, and sometimes that will be a case of working in conjunction with that other psychologist, so that, you know, you've got someone sort of who's helping out with those sort of more underlying things, but you might that sports person might still want the sports psychologist involved on just sort of helping out with the sporting side of things. So that's possible. Or it might be a case of, yeah, you refer them on, and then hopefully as they sort of come out the other side of that, they might come back to you or not. So, but yeah, there's a clear sort of, yeah, a sense of, you know, there are limitations to what I'm ethically competent to sort of deal with, and then I have to pass them on.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I feel like I'm taking up so much of your time. I'm going to ask you one more, if that's okay. So this one is from, this was from Cole, who says, do you think it would be smart for teams to mandate their players to have regular sessions with a sports psychologist, or would it be more beneficial for it to be encouraged but ultimately a decision on the part of the player?
Yeah, so I think this is such a good question. I mean, in general, I think with, you know, this applies to basically all we've spoken about today, but, you know, sports psychology or all psychology is a skill, essentially, you know, and or a set of skills that need to be practiced, like passing and dribbling and shooting and all the rest of it. So the extent to which you are willing to put in the effort and be open to doing it is therefore likely to have a pretty big impact on how successful you are at achieving those goals. So working with someone who really doesn't want to be there is going to be pretty fruitless and frustrating for both parties, for me and for the sports person. That being said, like, obviously, you know, you'd love to go into an environment and you could, like I said, you'll try and lay out, here's how this could be helpful to you. You know, and hopefully you can get the buy-in from those players or those sports people in that environment. In that moment, you can do a good enough job. I guess the biggest sort of, and you may also, I guess the other part of this is, like, you also potentially might have workshops or sort of group sessions. So it could be a case of, like, the whole team is required to go to a workshop where I'll be sort of telling them some concepts and giving them some tools and techniques, and maybe we'll be practicing them. And that very interesting article about Wickham that I know you guys sent around before we played them covers a lot of that, right? So the psychologists are working in groups with the players off the field, and then they're also basically standing there and watching training and helping in the moment as well in training sessions. So there's definitely the capacity to work with multiple individuals in a group setting as well. But I think what is the biggest benefit, I guess, so I think my overall answer would probably be, like, no, I wouldn't love it if it was mandated. I think the only benefit to doing that is it would help potentially remove any barriers, right? Like, because if it's a case of, like, you have to be seen walking down the corridor to the office of the sports psychologist to knock on the door, and if it is an environment where that might be stigmatized, that's unhelpful in and of itself. So a lot of what sports psychologists end up doing is, you know, kind of just making themselves very available. So kind of sitting in a nice, open, accessible place, keeping their door open if they have an office, but that's quite reasonably rare that happens. But, you know, like, so it's making yourself approachable and available. It's going over and basically sort of checking in with as many people as you can. So just going over and sort of saying, like, hey, how are you? Like, what's going on? How are you feeling today? And then you kind of, maybe that sparks something, and that might be a moment when they go, would it be okay if I come and see you later? Or, you know, obviously these days sort of maybe it's virtual or whatever, but maybe there's a way of then doing it. If you as the sports psychologist have sort of been seen to make the first move, and it's known that the sports psychologist comes over and does that to everyone, then maybe that helps sort of break down some of that reluctance, I guess. So that would be the only real benefit, I think, to doing it in that way.
That's so interesting. I just hadn't even considered that barrier existing, but it ties in with everything Jess said as well. And we are still in this country a little way behind other countries, I think, in terms of accepting that this is normal and helpful. Alex, this has been so interesting. I really, really appreciate your insight. I'm sure our listeners do too. It was a very popular episode last time when you were on. Is there anything you'd like to say about your company before we wrap up? I mean, I know, bizarrely, you actually did get some work off the back of your last podcast appearance. I think someone contacted you and said they heard you on The Extra Inch.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. We are, the company's called Optimize Potential. We've been running all through lockdown, helping people try and sort of stay motivated under the circumstances where they probably couldn't necessarily train in the way that they'd like to. And at the moment, obviously, people are starting to kind of, as lockdown eases and there's a bit of a timeline for getting back to it, we're starting to sort of help clubs or individuals with sort of, like, managing that. So managing expectations, trying to build confidence, and people potentially have very abbreviated seasons, so they don't have they might actually have some competitions but won't have had nearly as much preparation time, so how they can sort of try and approach that. And obviously a lot of that ties into that sort of challenge mindset of, all right, well, try and make the most of it, you know, for what it is. If that feels like something that anyone is interested in, I do also, I guess I should probably mention, I do also do a little bit of work with kind of professional performance as well. So a lot of the concepts that, well, basically all of the, you know, concepts that sports psychology covers in terms of performance and motivation and focus are almost always applicable in work scenarios as well. So there's also scope there. But yeah, other than that, I'm always just very happy to talk about sports psychology and help people learn. And I think, you know, coming back to that topic of sort of encouraging men to talk about their mental health and talk about their feelings and open up and be a bit vulnerable, I think it's useful. You know, I know you guys did a great job a couple of weeks ago in talking about the sort of how men can be better allies to women. And I was, you know, very, very, that was a great piece, and I was very sort of proud that this was a podcast I had appeared on, that you guys took that stand. But I think, you know, we all have a bit of a responsibility to sort of do what we can. So if this is a way that I can talk to a predominantly male listenership and say, hey, have you ever thought about your psychological well-being? Even if it's just chatting to you for a bit about Spurs mainly, then that's good. And it's just a pleasure to be involved in that process anyway.
Amazing. Thank you, Alex. Really, really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll catch up soon.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
React in a positive way. We need positivity for this second half.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.